It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.
Tonight on All In.
The president's words were reckless. It's clear he decided to be part of the problem.
Prosecutors investigating the Trump coup are seeking testimony from the former vice president.
If Mike Pence does the right thing, we win the election.
Tonight, the new reporting that Mike Pence is considering telling the DOJ what he wouldn't say to the January 6th committee. Then, another brutal mass shooting, this time at a Walmart in Virginia Beach. And Ben Collins on what we're learning about the Club Q shooter in Colorado. Plus, a new runoff controversy for Herschel Walker. Can a candidate hold a primary residence in Texas while running for Senate in Georgia? And why tonight could be the most important Thanksgiving Eve for Sarah Palin in quite some time. But All In starts right now. Good evening from New York. I'm Chris Hayes. The Department of Justice wants to talk to former Vice President Mike Pence. They want to talk to him about Donald Trump's attempt to foment a violent coup against these United States to disrupt the peaceful transfer of power for the first time in modern history. The reporting, which comes from the New York Times, notes, quote, Pence was present for some of the critical moments in which Trump and his allies schemed to keep him in office. And that reasoning is why this development doesn't really come as much of a surprise. We already know there were many key moments when Pence was essentially the only person in the room with Trump, as the ex-president attempted to pressure him to overturn the results of a free and fair election. And we know this in part because Pence's own White House counsel, a guy named Greg Jacob, repeatedly told the country as much during his public testimony in front of the January 6th committee about the days leading up to the insurrection.
Did the vice president ever waver in his position that he could not unilaterally decide which electors to accept?
The vice president never budged from the position that I have described as his first instinct, which was that it just made no sense from everything that he knew and had studied about our Constitution that one person would have that kind of authority.
Mr. Jacob, the president and the vice president meet again on that same topic the next day, January 5th, correct?
The vice president was then asked down to the Oval Office, and he went down to the Oval Office while Mark and I stayed back in the vice president's office.
You weren't in that meeting?
I was not.
And did the vice president have a call with the president that morning?
He did.
Were you with the vice president during the call?
We were told that a call had come in from the president. The vice president stepped out of the room to take that call, and no staff went with him.
A lot of one-on-one meetings, a lot of one-on-one conversations. Now, in those meetings, the days before January 6th, as Trump was getting increasingly desperate and erratic, Mike Pence was one of the only witnesses, maybe the best witness to testify to Trump's state of mind, as far as we know. So, again, it's no wonder why DOJ would want to speak to Pence, the guy that was on the other end of those conversations about what he and Trump discussed in those meetings. Now, whether or not Pence will actually testify is another question. The former vice president already firmly rejected any possibility of cooperating with the January 6th committee.
January 6th was a tragic day. And I've been very clear, as I am in my book, that the president's words and actions in and around January 6th were reckless.
Do you intend to ever sit and answer questions written in person for the January 6th committee?
I never stood in the way of senior members of my team cooperating with the committee and testifying. But Congress has no right to my testimony.
You're closing the door on that entirely.
I'm closing the door on that.
Okay, so Pence's answer there, not entirely surprising, right? I mean, after all, he wants to run for president himself, almost certainly in 2024. He's assembling a team. He's doing the kinds of things a candidate would do. And Republican primary voters are not exactly big fans of the January 6th committee. But the DOJ is a different beast entirely, a beast that it's a little harder to close the door on. There is an argument to be made that it would serve Pence's own political interests if, I don't know, Donald Trump were to get indicted before the next election, maybe even have a trial. In fact, the Times reports that Pence might very well cooperate with the Department of Justice. Quote, Pence, according to people familiar with his thinking, is open to considering the request, recognizing the Justice Department's criminal investigation is different from the inquiry by the January 6th committee. But anonymous sources telling the Times that they're open to considering testifying is not the same as confirming publicly you will testify if subpoenaed. And if Pence wanted to get out of participating, were he to be subpoenaed, which is what would happen, his old boss could try to give him a way out. Again, from the Times, quote, complicating the situation is whether Trump would try to invoke executive privilege to stop him or to limit Pence's testimony, a step he has taken with limited success so far with other former officials. Trump could certainly try to invoke executive privilege to prevent Pence from testifying. Whether or not he succeeds is a big, different story. Now, Trump already attempted to invoke privilege to stop Greb Jacob, that's the man you heard from a moment ago, and Mark Short, Pence's own chief of staff, from participating in the DOJ's investigation. In fact, from giving grand jury testimony in the January 6th investigation. But both men did ultimately testify before that grand jury as part of the inquiry. And here's the thing. Any attempt to invoke privilege would also be complicated by the fact that, as you heard Pence mention in that CBS interview, he's currently on a press tour plugging his book where he himself writes about and has published writing about his interactions with Trump before January 6th, the interactions in question. Now, privilege claims can be thorny and complicated. It's true the vice president's in a different position than his staffers, but it would certainly seem to me that if Pence can discuss Trump and the insurrection in a hardcover book for $22, he can tell a grand jury about it as well. Harry Littman's a former U.S. attorney and a former deputy assistant attorney general at the Department of Justice. Maya Wiley is a civil rights attorney and former assistant U.S. attorney, and they join me now. So, Harry, let me just start with you on how you think this goes. So, you know, the idea the Department of Justice is interested in his testimony, right? So the question is, well, what's next? What does this interaction between Pence World and the DOJ probably look like based on your experience?
So the political leverage here, I think, is with the department because Pence doesn't want to look too resistant. But more importantly, the legal leverage is with them. I know Mike's reporting said it could take months, but there's no reason that it should be harder to get Pence to testify than it was to get his counsel and chief of staff. And remember, as you say, he may have waived it. And it may also be the case that Biden's waived it. And at the end of the day, you really need his testimony singularly in the whole investigation. However, it's the kind of thing where that both parties may prefer a deal. Pence may prefer to not be looked like he's getting there at gunpoint. And the department as well, for its case, even though I think it has the goods on him, might prefer for him to be testifying voluntarily. So here's what's happening now. Emmett Flood, a sophisticated, good Washington lawyer, not like Trump lawyers, and the DOJ are discussing and circling. Flood might be probing. Could we maybe do it in written questions? Can you not subpoena and he'll be there voluntarily? Maybe it's not under oath. Maybe it's limited in some way to basically serve his interests to not have to be say everything. But he's going to need to give them information. And at the end of the day, if the DOJ wants to force him, and they can and they would.
And Maya, there's a fascinating political dynamic here, right? I mean, everyone looks at this field. And I think we look at Pence particularly, but all the field, and think, you know, what exactly is the plan here to get around Donald Trump? I mean, particularly if you're Mike Pence, like you're like Trump, but without the insurrection is sort of the shtick. But, you know, who is that being sold to? And it is the case, I think, that, you know, if the president were like convicted of a felony, that would change the field. And if you're Mike Pence, you might be able to help bring that along.
You know, look, I think you're absolutely right, Chris, that anybody who wants to seek the votes of the American people has to figure out, one, how are they running? Who are they? Who are they going to be? And who are they telling the American public they are? And which of that public are they trying to get on their side? You know, white suburban women, are someone everybody is trying to get on their side. I say that explicitly if you're thinking about politics, because you're also thinking about white suburban women and something that Pence actually said in his interview, right? Which he said, you know, after Trump tried to pressure him and he saw the tweet that went out that Pence knew put him in danger, put him in harm's way. In fact, as we saw, put him at risk of what literally was a lynching. That he turns to his daughter and he says, it doesn't take courage to violate the law, but it takes courage to stand up for it. And the question now is Pence looking to be the candidate that says, I'm the Republican candidate that is the hero in the story because I stood up for the rule of law? Or is he the person who wants to stand up and say, I stood up to protect Donald Trump?
It's such a good point, too, because it's clearly the case that the thesis of the book is that, right? That I'm MAGA through and through up until the coup, and I chopped off the train at the coup, and I tried to stop the train at the coup, right? But again, if that's your deal, Harry, to come back to you on the politics and optics here, right? It's hard for that to be your deal and then try to get out of what is obviously germane legal testimony to a criminal investigation by the Department of Justice.
100%. And it's basically impossible for him politically, I think, to do what other Trump partisans have done when pushed to the wall, take the Fifth.
That
he's
he can't
Mr.
Do,
Constitution, right. Yep. Mr. Pius, etc. But he would prefer not to look like he's being forced. And the department, in a sophisticated way, understands that as well. So as long as they'll give the information, it will be sort of consistent with the dignity he wants to have if he's walking in a voluntary way, but also he has to worry about the right flank, as you said, and the MAGA voters. It's just a delicate dance on both sides, but I think both sides see the virtue in not making it look like it's at, you know, legal command, but rather voluntary. And that's what this Ned Flood and DOJ, Emmett Flood, excuse me, and DOJ negotiations are about right now. Again, push comes to shove, the department will say, look, we need the testimony. We have a legal right to the testimony.
Yeah, to that point on pleading the Fifth, which I think is well taken, Maya, and to your point about the story he's telling, I think Harry's right there. It's just, he's not Roger Stone, and he's not Michael Flynn, and he can't go in and do a bunch of pleading the Fifth, right?
No, he can't, especially if he wants to run for office. There's just no Fifth here. But the other thing is, he's not the guy. You know, this isn't Peter Navarro, who wrote a kiss and tell book that said, Hey, don't forget me in the conspiracy. I was in the conspiracy too.
Right.
This is the book and this is the person and the potential candidate. He isn't a candidate yet, but the potential candidate that's saying, hey, I'm the guy that did the right thing. What's the Fifth that he's pleading for unless he wants to actually implicate himself in a conspiracy that right now he's not implicated in?
Yeah.
In fact, the opposite. He's implicated as the guy that said, oh, I'm not joining that conspiracy. And one other thing to remember here, because I completely agree with Harry here, but, you know, also, if you're Mike Pence's lawyer saying there is no executive privilege here, there's none. There's nothing that Trump is going to do and win on, by the way, legally, when the Supreme Court already said in January, hey, look, the district court said this is ridiculous, even for getting presidential records for the committee. This is a criminal investigation. Yeah. Mike is a fact witness, and he will have to testify one way or the other. And pleading the Fifth really isn't an option.
Yeah, that's a good point. Finally and quickly, Harry, on that point, that there's not really a privilege case here. The precedent here is all on the other side. You could try to kick the can, but then you're just kicking the can again. I think if you're Pence, you actually want to do this sooner rather than later, because the more drawn out it is, again, from that political standpoint, that's not the story you want front of mind for your Republican primary voters.
That's exactly right. You know, it's 100%. And even if you kick the can, I think it's only, you don't kick it very far here. Just, right. Maybe a month. Again, he wants to be, you know, looking like he's doing it on his own terms. DOJ wants the information. There's hopefully a way to do it where both parties are served. And that's what they're trying to negotiate over now.
Well, that grand jury better prepare itself for very, very high dosages of ponderousness when they get that testimony. Harry Lipman and Ryan Wiley, thank you very much. Coming up, is Alaskan politics about to be done with Sarah Palin? Tonight is the night that Alaska is tabulating its ranked choice vote rankings. We're literally getting results in as I speak. Will Palin lose to the Democrat Mary Peltola for the second time in 3 months? The dramatic ranked choice finish. Has that phrase ever been uttered? I'm not sure. Next. It's Thanksgiving Eve, and we are still doing election results because moments ago, the Alaska Division of Elections finished tabulating the votes from earlier this month, and we now have two breaking new election calls. NBC News just projected that Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski has won re-election, and Democrat Mary Peltola is the winner of the at-large congressional seat. Now, Congresswoman Peltola, the first Indigenous Alaskan to serve in Congress, defeated former governor and Republican vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin with nearly 55% of the vote. That's a live stream, I imagine, of the ranked choice voting that they beam out to the world as they tabulate there, the Alaska Division elections. Now, this has been another not-so-great run-up to Thanksgiving for Palin. 14 years after her infamous turkey pardoning gaffe, if you have a weak stomach, you may want to look away.
Hey, everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.
Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
Oh, well, this was neat. I was happy to get to be invited to participate in this. And for one, you need a little bit of levity in this job, especially with so much that has gone on in the last couple of months that has been so political, obviously, that it's nice to get out and do something to promote a local business and to just participate in something that isn't so heavy-handed politics that invites criticism. Certainly, we'll probably invite criticism for even doing this, too, but at least this was fun.
Now, on a serious note, this is all happening now, 2 weeks after the election, because Alaska's got this new voting system. Alaska voters now rank up to four candidates in each race instead of choosing only one. If no candidate receives 50% plus one of the vote, as was the case in Alaska's at-large congressional district, the Division of Elections moves on to count the voters' second choices.
The candidate who gets the least number of first-choice votes is eliminated. Then, tabulation starts in rounds. If your first choice was not eliminated, your vote stays with them and gets counted in the next round. If your first choice was eliminated, your second choice is now counted. This keeps happening in rounds until two candidates are left, and the one with the most votes wins.
Bunch of places use this. Maine uses it. New York City actually used it for its primary here. Tonight, that is what happened for Democratic Congresswoman Mary Peltola, who will serve in this next Congress in the seat formerly held by Don Young. For more on this momentous night of ranked choice drama, I'm joined by Michelle Goldberg, opinion columnist for The New York Times. It is an amazing trajectory for Sarah Palin. You and I are sort of in the same age cohort, right? We both covered that race in 2008. And she was like a shooting star that lit up the night sky. She was a a sensation, a star, and an attentional sensation. Everyone was thinking about her, talking about her. SNL, she was everywhere, and everyone had their eyes on her.
Right, and she set the stage for Donald Trump, or at least totally. In many ways was the model for Donald Trump. And the fact that she's been sort of losing her shine for years now is one reason why I'm a little bit skeptical of people who believe that Donald Trump's hold on the Republican Party is eternal, right? I mean, I certainly think that we shouldn't assume that he's just going to go away, but this shtick does get old. People do lose their novelty and their allure, and things are just always changing. And the other thing I think is interesting about Sarah Palin is she could have had such a different career. I mean, as you said, when she was chosen, there was, you know, Democrats were terrified. She seemed electric. The media was kind of in love with her until those very embarrassing interviews. And had she sort of pursued the path that she had pursued somewhat as governor. I mean, she was very right-wing, but she wasn't as much of a kind of full-time provocateur when she was governor of Alaska. She could have had a huge career on the national stage, right? I mean, the path that she went on was a choice.
Yeah, she could have probably had a good shot at being the nominee, but she stopped being the governor. She decided to be a kind of like a full-time sort of what right-wing celebrity. I think a little earlier than that was a plausible path to presidency, which, again, the proof of concept that Donald Trump ends up proving. But she was very much, you know, this kind of troll politics. I'll never forget being in that room at the RNC in 2008 in the Twin Cities when she was giving her speech. And at one point, she turned to talk about she didn't call it the fake news, but the right. media, and the place went nuts. And everyone started pointing and cursing and giving the middle finger, braying up at the camera booths. And it was very much Trump before Trump. And I remember it being in that moment like, ooh, something real dark and unsettling is being unleashed in front of me right now.
Right. And then we've seen the consequences over the last few years of that being unleashed and kind of growing and growing and growing until it nearly brought the country to its knees. You know, but I do think it's interesting that the people who know her the most, right, the people who've watched her
Incredible.
Ascent up close, and 55, 45 is not a normal margin in a kind of swing congressional race, right? Like, you don't see people in swing districts winning by 10%.
And, by the way, it was lamestream media. Thank you, Brendan, really getting in my ear, who has the scars for all the Palin coverage he's done in his life. The lamestream media. But yes, that's a great point. And I remember when she said, when Don Young died in office and there was going to be a special election, there's a whole bunch of candidates. And when she declared, I was like, oh, we're just going to have Sarah Palin as a political figure. Like, I just, in my head, I was like, I think she'll probably win. She won statewide. And we're just going to now have Sarah Palin.
It's a Republican seat.
And we're going to have Sarah Palin. And maybe we'll have now, is this like the Sarah Palin 2.0? She can be a member of Congress. Who knows what else? And in two consecutive elections, for Alaskans to be like, no, we don't want the shtick. We want the woman who's like really focused on like our fisheries and like and like our healthy fish population, and someone who's like the opposite of Sarah Palin and seems very liked and respected on all sides, is not a polarizing character, is really like a complete different way of doing politics than her.
Well, I also think that, you know, ranked choice voting is kind of depolarizing.
Yeah,
right.
That's a good point. That's the idea behind it.
I mean, right. It's depolarizing both because it means that sort of the most pivotal thing isn't who wins the primary, you know, so you don't kind of outsource these decisions entirely to the rabid base in primary elections. But it's also depolarizing because it gives you an incentive to try to win over the entire electorate as opposed to just turning out your base. Because even the people who might not vote for you in the first round
could get you in the second.
Right.
Right. And so, right, exactly. And so the idea of, right, the political logic which propelled Donald Trump in that primary in 2016, which was, I've got this incredible hold on 30% of the population. Everyone came around, but I can hold this plurality. And it's the same thing he has right now, larger than 30%. Is the opposite math of like, can I be broadly appealing to a whole bunch of people? Which again, used to be one of the key recipes of politics that has been kind of lost, but I think resurrected a little bit in these midterms.
Well, right. I mean, part of ranked choice voting is part of the story here. And then part of the broader story, I think, is a rejection of Sarah Palin style politics, Trumpist politics, obviously, and the loss of all of these Stop the Steal candidates. And I think, you know, and I also don't think you can, underestimate the impact of abortion and the Dobbs decision in this race. You know, I think, you know, she ran, Mary Petola ran as the pro-choice, pro-fisheries candidate.
Yeah, she was pro-choice and she was pro-fish. We've had her on the program. She's one of the most fascinating members of Congress, I think, of the entire country. And she now has been reelected in a short span. She will be representing the state of Alaska in their at-large seat held for decades by Don Young. Michelle Goldberg, great to have you. Have a great Thanksgiving.
Thank you. You too.
Still ahead, two mass shootings thousands of miles apart, apparently connected by hateful rhetoric on the internet. Ben Collins on the poison fueling these attacks next.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts, former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now. If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.
Last night, the country experienced yet another deadly mass shooting. It happened at a Walmart in Chesapeake, Virginia. The gunman, a night manager at the store, opened fire on his colleagues in the break room, killing at least six people and wounding six more before taking his own life. Tonight, the city of Chesapeake released the names of the victims. They are Lorenzo Gamble, age 43, Brian Pendleton, 38, Kelly Pyle, 52, Randall Blevins, 70, and Tanika Johnson, age 22. The sixth victim is a 16-year-old resident of Chesapeake, Virginia. His name and photo are being withheld because he is a minor. Now, this latest mass murder happened just 3 days after another gunman killed five people and injured 18 others at an LGBTQ nightclub in Colorado Springs. That shooting came amid a slew of anti-gay and anti-trans sentiment voiced by many on the right. Now we are learning the gunman has deep ties to internet hate groups. Ben Collins is a senior reporter at NBC News. He covers online extremism, has been researching the Colorado suspect's online presence. Ben, before you start, let me just say I misread the prompter before. There's no internet connection for the other mass shooting, as far as we know. In fact, we don't know the motive at all. In this case, though, what have we learned about the shooter here?
That's true. So with the Colorado shooter, we have learned several things. First of all, they have we've traced down an online account tied to him, which was very hard. There is not much under his actual name. That's in part because he changed his name a few years ago to an entirely different name to separate his original name from his father. They reached out to his father earlier today, a bunch of media networks, and they asked him about the shooting. And he said he had talked to attorneys, and the attorneys told him he had shot up a gay bar. And the father said, I asked if he was gay. And they said, no. And he said, and the father said, phew, as in like, phew, he's not gay.
Yeah.
That's the sort of lifestyle he was living in. But the larger thing that we learned about his online identity was he was in an internecine feud, I would say, with a hate site called Encyclopedia Dramatica. That site has been tied to two different mass killings. One is a guy named William Atchison back from 2017. He shot up a school in New Mexico, killed two people. He was a sysop or an admin at that website. What's notable about this website specifically is that it has a kill count for mass shooters. And it's almost like a high score thing. It's actually a section of the site called High Scores. And if you target gay people or minorities, they note that with slurs in the profile. And they have updated his profile to note that as well. Also, because of this, I just want to note this really quickly, Chris. Because of this, he was mercilessly bullied, and he tried to bully back these same people on this website for years. And he was living with his grandmother. And at one point, according to local news there, there's some leaked documents to a specific holdup that was at the grandmother's house once. and they were threatening to move to Florida. And he said that we can't move to Florida because it would interfere with my bomb making. He was threatening to do a mass shooting and have a and making a bomb in the basement. They called the police on that. The grandmother did as well. So this is what we've learned in the past couple of days. It's just slowly dribbling out now.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my top line here is just like the worst, darkest parts of anywhere that you could be spending time on the internet. I want to ask you about something. I don't, you know, we don't know the motive that, that he is in custody. It looks, you know, according to officials and according even to the mayor of Colorado Springs, that are the hallmarks of a hate attack. Obviously, the public defenders for the shooter yesterday said that they go by they/them pronouns, that they are non-binary. I don't know if that's true, and I'm happy to take the lawyers at the word at their word. Yeah. But it also seems possible that's a troll based on the weird culture he's embedded with. I don't know, and I don't know what to make of it, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, this guy lived in very deep troll sections of the internet. This is like the deepest trenches of trolling, to have an entry on Encyclopedia Dramatica and to know about it and to fight back against it. That is deep in online troll culture that is virulently homophobic, virulently racist. And look, this is what that paperwork said last night. That's something that we absolutely should note, and we have to note. But if you talk, for example, the Daily Beast, Rebecca Hopkins, talked to neighbors who knew him personally. And they are adamant that he never, in any way, identified as that. And also that his mom, and we can confirm this too, that his mom referred to him as he, on the day of the shooting, both in text messages on Facebook. So it's possible, and that's certainly the narrative that is running through the far right internet, that this was somehow not tied to homophobia in any way, but the five hate crimes charges kind of run in the face of that.
Yeah. Again, I think it's probably the darkest thing possible. I think the remembrances that we've seen for the survivors and for those who died have been remarkable. The way that that community has come together has been remarkable. And I think in some ways, the Walmart shooting just 3 days later illustrates how guns end up being the through line, no matter where the darkness comes from in its origination. Ben Collins, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Chris.
Still to come, Georgia Senate candidate Herschel Walker could be among the worst major candidates in recent history. Now a new report says he may not even live in Georgia at all, or at least not like his primary residence. That's ahead. This week, we have a fascinating new episode on my podcast, Why Is This Happening?, where I got a chance to talk to a former currency trader turned soldier who is currently right now fighting in Ukraine. He's a British man who goes by the pseudonym Macer Gifford. He fought against ISIS in Syria from 2015 to 2017, arrived in Ukraine just 10 days before the Russian invasion. And he explained how actual combat quickly separates out the adventure seekers from those who are truly invested in the cause.
I've been hit by suicide bombs. I've been shot myself. I've been blown up. Just about everything has happened to me. And believe me, you're not laughing then. So it's, I think it also reminds you that if you are not motivated by it for the right reasons, you'll just go home. So also it sort of separates people. It separates the wheat from the chaff, as the old expression goes. That if you're there just for an adventure or just for the thrill of it, getting shot at or blown up will bring you back to reality pretty quickly. But if you genuinely care and you want to continue on and you're there for a reason, then you find a way to put up with the madness and the horribleness of the situation, and you move on and you carry on.
That episode is out right now, so go take a listen wherever you listen to your podcast. You can also get it by scanning that QR code you see on your screen. While you're at it, you may be in preparations to head over the river, through the woods, to grandma's house, wherever you might be spending the Thanksgiving holiday. You could also queue up a WithPod playlist. A few of my favorites from this year, my conversation with Jamal Green about the right-wing Supreme Court, where you compare my exclusive sit down with Rachel Maddow as a coda to her really, truly excellent podcast, Rachel Maddow Presents Ultra. I had a really enlightening conversation, unfortunately germane, as always, with former gun industry insider named Ryan Bussey, and a heartbreaking conversation with Canadian journalist Connie Walker on her tremendous reporting into Canadian Indian residential schools. As we find our way through our third pandemic winter, my conversation with Dr. Thomas Fisher about the experience of emergency physicians, particularly during COVID, and it's still sadly very timely. We'll tweet out this list so you can listen to all these more wherever you get your podcasts. Trump-endorsed Senate nominee in Georgia, Herschel Walker, has been one of the worst political candidates we've ever seen run for Senate. Just yesterday, the second woman to say that Walker allegedly pressured her into having an abortion gave a press conference. She appeared on camera, though she did not disclose her name. At the presser, she came forward with what she claims to be new evidence supporting their relationship. See that picture there? I should tell you, Walker says this woman is lying. NBC News has not independently verified her claims. But Walker has said that he supports a national ban on abortion. He has called abortion murder and does not support exceptions for rape or incest. This is precisely the kind of vetting problem that everyone in Republican circles was warning about back when Donald Trump handpicked the former football star and Celebrity Apprentice contestant to be his chosen Senate candidate in Georgia. But it's not the only big problem with Walker's candidacy. There are many. But another one is that he doesn't really live full-time in Georgia. Like failed Pennsylvania Republican Senate candidate Mehmet Oz, Walker's a carpetbagger. Now, it's true, Walker has strong roots in the state of Georgia. He played college football at the University of Georgia, won the Heisman Trophy. But today, a new report shows Walker is getting a tax break on his house in Dallas, Texas, one that is intended only for a primary residence. Walker's campaign did not respond to a request for comment from the New York Times. We've also reached out and have not heard back. The new information calls into question Walker's standing as a real resident running for Senate in the state of Georgia. Charles Blow lives in Atlanta, Georgia. He's a columnist for the New York Times. He's written quite a bit on Herschel Walker's campaign, and he joins me now. You know, Charles, I remember when Walker was being floated very early on because Donald Trump had a relationship with him, had had him on a contestant on his show, and in his sort of like, you know, fixed idea way was like, Walker should run in Georgia. And at the time, I remember reading a bunch of articles being like, well, he doesn't live in Georgia. He lives outside Dallas. He probably should live in Georgia. And that issue is still there, even though it does seem like it went away. It's not like Warnock tried to do to Walker what Fetterman did to Oz.
Yeah, Warnock is just not that kind of an attack dog. He's not your traditional politician. He's a pastor of a church. You get that sensibility from him. People here in Georgia always knew that they were kind of bringing Herschel Walker back into Georgia to run. He was a carpetbagger from the beginning. That is the least of the problems, however, with the running of Herschel Walker. He is completely, completely ill-equipped to be a senator or elected official of any sort on any level. And everyone here knows that, even the people who vote for him know that, but they are locked in. Now they have no other candidate. When they had a chance to really challenge Herschel Walker, which you'll be in the primaries, no one did it because he was Donald Trump's pick. All of this would have come out. They probably would have had a stronger candidate. There was a lot of resentment or fear of Stacey Abrams, which drove a lot of vote to Kemp. You know, I don't know if people remember this, but Marjorie Taylor Greene once said on, I think it was on a podcast, that her voters were telling her that they would move out of the state rather than be governed by Stacey Abrams. The idea of a Black person, a Black woman, Stacey Abrams, governing the people of Georgia freaked people out. And so Kemp had that advantage. Walker, or the candidate who is in the Republican seat on the Senate side, would have also had it, but he's terrible. And so he didn't have it. And so this is a big problem. This idea of him being a carpetbagger and getting a tax break in Texas only adds us marginally to that because there's so much other stuff that disqualifies him from being a senator from Georgia.
I mean, the thing about Herschel Walker, and here's where I do think there's a little bit of a similarity with Mehmet Oz. It's like when Mehmet Oz was running for senator in Pennsylvania, I was like, what's the argument? What's the logic? Mehmet Oz, Pennsylvania senator. right? Like Pat Toomey, he was a Republican congressman before. Like, you know, Katie Britt, who just got elected in Alabama, worked in Alabama politics. I believe she was a Richard Shelby staffer in Alabama, right? So, you know, there's a certain logic there. It's like, why is this person going to be the senator from this place? There's literally no reason other than name recognition and Donald Trump likes him. That is the sum total of the argument for why this individual should represent this state in the U.S. Senate.
I mean, I think they can make a slightly stronger case if, in fact, he had any other qualification to be a senator, which he does not. But they could probably make a slightly stronger case because he is a son of Georgia, right? So he is born here, raised here. He goes to college. He goes to high school here, college here. So there, it's not like he's completely disconnected from the state of Georgia. He's just disconnected from reality. Like, he's disconnected from intellect. He's disconnected from qualifications. That's the bigger problem.
There's also, I mean, one of the things that's happened in the abortion discussion here where, you know, there have been, there was the first reporting in which the woman said that, who actually had a son with Herschel Walker, said that in one case he pressured for an abortion, actually pressured her for a second, though she didn't have it. She showed a Get Well Soon card. There was a receipt from the abortion clinic where she received the abortion. You know, a lot of this is sort of, the way that it's been kind of characterized is like, oh, these dark stories from his past. But to me, the key thing is he would vote for a national abortion ban. Like, that is the position that he is running on. That is the party that he wants to be a part of. And this demonstrates the fundamental hypocrisy or unseriousness about that. I wonder what role you think, given on this day when we have news that Georgia Supreme Court has now reinstated the state's ban of abortion after 6 weeks. What role abortion has played in this race? What role you think it will play in the last few weeks of the runoff?
I think it has played a role in this race in the same way that it has played in other races. Because it is not a separate line on the ballot, it plays a little bit less of a role. Yep. You have to kind of vote by proxy that this person is with the party that opposes the thing that I am in favor of. I think the big question, though, the thing that we don't talk enough about is that child is alive.
Yeah.
Right. This is the party that talks incessantly about absent Black fathers. And Herschel Walker is, by all measures, an absent Black father to that child. How the Republicans in this state have made twisted themselves into not kind of put Herschel Walker into the basket. They put all other Black people in. Right. If any other Black person on the liberal side would show up not being able to make a sentence, they'd attack and lambast that person. But not Herschel Walker, because he's saying what they want to hear. Any other Black person who was an absentee father who was advocating for abortion for the people who he impregnated would be lambasted by these people. But because he's saying the things that they want to hear, they excuse it. He is any other Black person who behaved in the way that Herschel Walker behaves, but happened to be liberal and actually supporting policies that help Black people, would be lambasted by the Georgia Republicans who are now supporting and excusing and making excuses for Herschel Walker.
Yeah, I mean, the way that I've run the thought experiment in my head is just take 30 seconds to consider what would be the electoral results in the divided state of Georgia if the Black Democratic nominee for a statewide office had Herschel Walker's package. I mean, it's just like, obviously, it's not going to happen. You've now got the full team trying to pull him over the finish line, including the governor, Brian Kemp, who I think helped him probably the first time around because he's relatively popular and was on the ballot. He's not this time. He will be campaigning for him. I wonder if you think how much that matters, that A, it's a runoff without any other offices, or B, that Kemp is campaigning for him.
Listen, Kemp has to do this to stay in the good graces of the Republican Party, because Donald Trump already hates him. And so the only other part of the party that he can appeal to is the Senate Republicans, Mitch McConnell and the like, who need help. They want to have the extra seat, even though it doesn't mean that they're going to get control of the Senate. It does strengthen their hand in the Senate. Kemp is trying to stay in their graces. Kemp wants nothing to do with Herschel Walker, and he proved that during his campaign for governor. And no one wants to touch Herschel Walker, but they have to stay in the good grace of the Republican Party. And so they do their due diligence. They do what the party is asking them to do.
Yeah, it has been quite a spectacle, this entire race. Charles Blow, great pleasure to have you on. Have a great holiday. Thank you.
You too. Thank you.
That is all in on this Thanksgiving Eve. You know, I realize today that this is the 10th one of these we have done. To those of you who have been watching throughout, a hearty thank you. Have a great holiday, all of you.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at msnbc.com/win.